Hello. They were trying. They're working on it. I'll start in a little over a minute. So the Zoom is on?
Yes, it's on, recording.
Okay.
Just this. I don't want to turn on the auto chat previews.
And if you can make this continually bright, that would be great.
That I don't know about.
That's important for reading.
This isn't.
And I'm going to start while you're doing this.
Certainly.
In about 10 seconds.
There we go. We got that leg going.
You're forcing me to wear my glasses.
I'm afraid so. There's no light aimed at this spot. So I apologize for that.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Jonathan Oxhorn, Emeritus Professor of Architecture and Senate Speaker, here for Season 4, Episode 1 of Eve DeRose's term. We start with a land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayukono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayukono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayukono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayukono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. The meeting is now called to order. Our first order of business is to approve the minutes from May 8th, 2024. These have been posted and distributed online in the form of a verbatim transcript. So if there are no objections, we will consider them approved. If you have minor corrections, you can always send them to the Dean of the Faculty. So we're going to start with a proposed resolution on enhancing transparency in the tenure process, external reviewers. Tracy Stokel is online, I hear, professor and chair of academic freedom and professional status of the faculty committee. She will speak for 10 minutes, and then there will be 10 minutes allotted for Senate discussion. And let me just remind everyone, since it's the first meeting, that typically people who are commenting either online or in the audience should take no more than 2 minutes. So, Tracy, are you here?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Yep.
Okay, great. Thank you. So this is actually a revised resolution or a proposal to revise a resolution that was approved as far back as December 2021. And our committee, the Academic Freedom and Professional Status of Faculty, took it up again because we started discussing external reviews in one of our meetings. So what we have here is snapshots from the revised resolution. And what you see in red is pretty much mostly wordsmithing, which is just reducing the verbiage in the document and just changing it a little. So the red lettering is deletions, and anything in bold is considered an addition. So there were some things that I wanted to actually highlight And the first thing that I wanted to highlight is that one of the reasons why we changed this resolution is because we disagreed with the resolution on what is considered an external reviewer. In the original resolution, the external reviewer was considered someone who isn't in the unit or department, but could still be at Cornell or could be still within the college, but just in a different department. And we felt that that was not the general perception of what an external reviewer is. So we revised it to say that an external reviewer is external to Cornell University and took out the bit of it being not a voting member of the candidate's unit. And then again, just a little bit of wordsmithing changes, so nothing major else in this part of the resolution that was revised. Can I have the next slide, please? So again, this is just rewording that a little bit, and that's very minor changes. Next slide, please. So there is nothing to be changed with this except these two minor changes is a slight deletion and an addition. And next slide, please. And the list, again, most of this is just wordsmithing. And I believe this should have been provided to the senators. And if not, we can certainly provide it and put it up on the Faculty Senate website so that you can actually read the changes, because I'm definitely not giving you enough time to read them. I read really quickly. Next slide, please. So the other substantive change is two, and they're listed on here. So in discussion through the dean of the faculty, we wanted to get some idea of what is a number that people should aim for, because we keep hearing these disparate things. So we wanted some guidance given to the different units. And the guidance that we received was that 8 external reviewers is a suggested minimum. Then the committee felt fairly strongly that we should add this wording about the list, that the list should include reviewers that were asked and declined. And if they give a reason for declining, then that reason should be given. And we wanted to emphasize that individuals that decline to review a promotion dossier, that this should not reflect badly on the candidate and not be taken as that the reviewer doesn't think that the person is suitable for tenure. So we definitely wanted that language in here. So everything in bold here, which I'll give you a little bit of time to read, were some additions that we really wanted to include that were not in the original resolution.
I turned off the video.
And then next slide is pretty much the resolution itself, and that's really hardly changed. And again, just taking out some acronyms just to make it easier reading. And so the actual resolution is not really changed. It's just the verbiage above, which there are minor changes. And that was my presentation. So I'm happy to answer any questions that the Senate may have.
If you're online and have a question or comment, raise your hand digitally. If you're here in this place, step up to the front and grab one of these microphones. You can't. Okay, this was someone asking the text to be larger, if possible, in the space here. Meanwhile, while we're fiddling with the text, if anyone has a question or comment in this room, there are microphones that you can take. Just come right up and I'll let you.
And if there are no questions or comments.
No, there is a question.
Sorry.
Ken Berman online. Go ahead.
Ken Berman, Senator from Computer Science. These changes seem reasonable to me, but I have a question about one of them. You've indicated that you don't want internal reviewers, but I can think of times over the years where somebody internal to Cornell but in a different department is a world expert on a topic, and where we have needed to solicit those letters, although quite reasonable to tabulate them separately, but to actually say they cannot be reviewers strikes me as strong. Can you explain the rationale there?
No, we never said that at all. We just said that the external reviewers were clarifying external letters, not those considered internal letters. So if there is someone, as you said, who's a subject matter who's not in the voting unit, they would be considered an internal reviewer and not an external reviewer. There is absolutely, this has nothing to do with additional reviews that do come from either within the unit or within the college, but they're still considered internal to Cornell University as a whole, and that was our rationale.
And thank you.
Kent, this is Eve. The University Faculty Committee considered this resolution and also came to the same conclusion that there's nothing to negate those expert letters from within Cornell. What we're talking about are the minimum number of external letters should all be arm's length and outside of Cornell. And while I'm up here, anybody from the UFC, please correct me if I've missed anything. Another piece of feedback that came, Tracy, was about having equal, identical numbers of identical numbers of external reviewers listed by the candidate and listed by the department. What was more important to the committee, they felt that was maybe being too prescriptive, but rather ensuring the independence of it so that the candidate's list is independent of the department creating their list. And then also, they also liked the labeling of the source, whether it was the candidate's list or the department's list or for the external reviewers.
Okay, so my understanding is that they wanted to take out the equal numbers and just provide the candidate. We need a minimum of 8 external letters. Chair should inform their candidate that a lot of people say no just because they're asked all the time and they say no for that reason. So they're giving as many names as possible, but leave it for the units, I guess. I guess one of the reasons why we said equal numbers is because we didn't want it to be weighted. The selection of the external letters, we wanted equal opportunity, I guess, for the candidate to provide external reviewers, so as well as the department to provide external reviewers, and so that when the chair solicited these reviews, that he or she could choose from equally from both lists. So if the candidate's list is only 3 people long and the department's list is 15 people long, then it's really going to be disparate and it's going to be weighted more heavily on the department list. So let me take that back to the committee and see if they want that, because I think that making them equal number of lists is a fairer process than saying that they shouldn't be equal. And I'm not sure that's being too prescriptive, but let me take it back to the committee with that feedback that we received.
Okay, we have another comment online or question. Tara, go ahead.
Thanks. I'm Tara Holm. I'm in the math department. And I would sort of emphasize what Eve is saying. In mathematics, which is part of arts and sciences, we have to have at least 7 letters and at least 5 of them have to not come from the candidate. And so if you impose equal numbers, that then implies we need to have a list of at least 10. I mean, then we need to have at least 10 letters, which becomes quite a burden on my colleagues, you know, on my colleagues, external colleagues. So I the equal numbers would be quite a burden, I think.
For the faculty member to, you're saying equal numbers for the candidate to come up with the same numbers as the department?
That would be a burden. I mean, it would also be a burden though on, you know, I as chair have to make a heavy request to a lot of people. I mean, logically, I have to then ask at least 10 people, or I have to get at least 10 letters. So I'm going to have to ask at least 12 or 15 people to get 10 letters, and 10 people are going to be spending a big effort to write letters. So it it is just adding to the workload.
Yeah, so I guess the lists are just, so I don't see this adding to the chair's workload. It's more asking the candidate to think of, I guess, at least if you're saying you need at least 12 to 14 people because some people refuse, that you would ask the department to come up with six and the candidate to come up with six or seven. It's just providing the names, and it's up to the chair to decide who uses that. And then at least the faculty can see in the ad hoc committees and factor can see of the people that provided letters, this number came from the canon, this number did not. So it's just more that we feel the candidate should be given equal opportunity to provide the same number of suggestions for external reviewers, but who the department chair chooses is really up to them. We're not saying that the number of, that the letters that are solicited have to be equal between the two sections.
Okay, but then, I mean, it puts the candidate in a weird position where they're meant to be identifying experts, but then if the department can only solicit two from the candidate's list, because we're not allowed to have so many that are from the candidate's list, we have to have plenty that we have independently identified as experts. It just means the people that we, you know, the candidate may identify the obvious experts, and then we're going to have to ask the non-obvious experts or non-obvious non-experts, and we're not going to be getting as good letters. It feels quite prescriptive to me, I guess what I'm trying to say.
Okay. So in a smaller field, you're saying that it's going to be difficult for a department or a candidate to necessarily come up with enough names. So you're proposing that it's just, yeah. Okay, so this was in the original resolution. This never came up previously. And I'm just not sure what the solution is that would make people happy.
We have another comment or question online. Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, Ken Berman again, computer science. First of all, I was wondering, can you show us the language on this exact point? I want to make sure it's consistent with what we do in computer science, done it for 40 years. We normally ask the candidate to supply eight or so letter names. The department develops a very large list that might have 30 or 40, and then we have a faculty meeting of tenured faculty. We'll decide who we want to write to, typically 12, and then we'll make sure that we've ended up with a couple from the candidate's list. But so this notion of an equal number from the two strikes me as being at odds with what we've historically done. And I agree with the comment that trying to have equity there can easily have the effect of substantially weakening the quality of the selection that we're able to make.
Can we go back one slide? Is that possible? So it says the length of the independently the views. I think we may have to go back one more. The list should be equal in length. Yeah, so you see, I haven't modified that. That was in the original resolution that was passed in December 2021. So that did not come up. I will take this back to the committee and say this has now become a concern. Since we're revising, this is a new opportunity to change things, particularly if you're not doing it. I see there's another question.
We have a question or a comment from Harold Hodes. Go ahead.
Harold Hodes in philosophy. It isn't completely clear to me what the value is in having an equal number of initial names suggested by the candidate and by the department. I mean, different departments are very different. In some cases, it might be that a candidate's colleagues are pretty ignorant about good names to choose and would want to give more weight to what the candidate suggests. In other departments, there might just be so many appropriate names that the initial list coming from the department, it would make sense for it to be longer than the initial list coming from the candidate. I don't see what the great value is in going for uniformity, and thus all departments have to be using initially start with equal number with lists of equal length.
Okay, well, thank you. I really appreciate all these comments. And as I said, we'll take this back to the committee. And if anyone wants to read this in more detail, all the revisions, and would like have additional comments to make, please email me directly. We're meeting again on the 26th of September. So if you could get that back to me then so that I can get this on the Faculty Senate for potentially voting next faculty meeting. It would be great to get this result, but I really appreciate hearing these comments that additional revisions are suggested. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any comments online or in person. I'll wait like a few seconds to see if anything pops up since we still have a few minutes. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next agenda item. We have a customer here. Pick up one of those microphones and see if they work. Any of them.
Oh, no, sorry. I'm this guy.
Oh, you're the next guy. Okay, my apology. I have to introduce you. Engaging viewpoint diversity in the classroom. We have in person Steve Jackson, Information Science and Vice Provost for Academic Innovation, who will talk for 10 minutes, after which we will have 20 minutes for discussion. So go ahead. Sorry.
We're also joined by Rob Vanderlyn, who many of you know, director of the Center for Teaching Innovation. So we actually are cramming in three different things. I'm going to talk about one. Rob will then take over, and then I'll talk about the third one. Next slide, please. All right, so this is an update item. Those of you who were on the Senate last fall may remember I came to you in November with a set of concerns that faculty had begun expressing around recording and sharing of information from lectures or classes with the outside world. We discussed some of the versions of this, some of the particular concerns that drove that. There was interest in this expressed at the Senate meeting and afterwards. We went off and did a bunch of work on this. And I'm not going to talk through these, but I'm happy to in discussion. Next slide, please. And so we worked with the EPC, thank you EPC, University Council, sorry that should be lowercase, I mean the university lawyers, to update the Academic Integrity Code. We decided this was the best way to address this kind of concern. You don't need to look through all this way too much text on a way too small screen. What I want to point out to you is the takeaways. Basically where we arrived at is that there should be no recording without instructor awareness and permission, but acknowledging that there are important SDS and second language reasons for recording. Secondly, even in cases where instructors have given materials to all members in due course as a default, or that people have been granted permission to record, that there should be no sharing beyond the classroom environment without the express consent of instructors. This is now written into the Academic Integrity Code. This is language that was developed for the Academic Integrity Code. This has gone out to students in the essential guide to academic integrity that the students get, undergrads get, I guess maybe graduate students get as well, each fall. So this is mostly an announcement item that this thing that we talked about last fall has been worked through and this is now in place. Any quick responses on this question? Yeah.
Okay, this way. Elliot, I feel like I'm ready to answer. Elliot Shapiro, Knight Institute for Writing in the Disciplines and RTE at Large in Arts and Sciences. I'm glad to see this. I think this is really important. I am very curious to know why it does not apply to office hours or other faculty-student interactions.
Yeah, good question. So this gets a little bit legalistic, but New York is a one-party consent state for recording, which means the default in the state is anyone can record anyone else at any point without permission. So we're already doing a carve-out against the basic intent of the law. What we're basically saying is that we believe classroom spaces, we have a compelling interest, legal terms, in the distinctive nature of classroom spaces to override what is otherwise the intent of state law here. And we believe we can stand behind this if a case were to come forward. Once you start talking about office hours, it starts looking like many other kinds of interactions in many other kinds of organizations, and it's not clear that we can make a case that university office interactions are so radically different than other kinds of office interactions in other fields and industries such that we could uphold this under law. I recognize that I recognize this is a concern sometimes expressed by faculty. This policy does not cover that, and our judgment right now is that this policy can't be stretched to include that. But I am happy to talk about that more or take feedback out of the meeting around that.
May I ask a question? I'm not sure if there are... Hello?
Yeah, Florentina, please.
Hi. I cannot hear what else is happening in the room. So this is more towards the way this thing is worded. Florentina Buna in statistics. Does this resolution or would this resolution apply to taking photos? So I specifically, I have Blackboard. I mean, I give Blackboard lectures, and you know, there is a consistent stream of photography happening during my lectures. So
Yes, this does apply to photos. This would be photos taken in the classroom. Okay. Would be covered
in
under
the classroom.
This policy. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Brisa Lieberwitz, ILR. I just would find it useful if you could review, because I don't recall, did we vote on something at the prior meeting? And in general, what is the process for changing the Academic Integrity Code?
So we didn't take a formal vote when I came last fall. We went and worked with the EPC. EPC helped develop this language in this text. Eve, you may want to speak to this. My understanding is that this was perceived as an adjustment to the Academic Integrity Code and not something requiring a vote, but Eve, you may.
Yes, that, and also the urgency of it, considering the faculty were feeling very vulnerable in the classroom, and so we felt like we should address it immediately, have it go through our Education Policy Committee, but you guys will learn. We have an academic integrity working group, and we're revising the code. So that's why I feel like the work through shared governance in terms of the Senate will happen this year. So at this time, we just needed to add the recordings to our academic integrity. Because we already have the thing about sharing notes. This was just saying notes and recordings, basically.
So there's two other people standing. I'm going to suggest we take these two and then move on to our next topic, but I'm happy to take other questions after and separately. So, yeah, Michael.
Michael Clarkson, Senator, Computer Science. Since this is in the Academic Integrity Code, that means penalties for this usually involve grade penalties in the course. I'm trying to imagine what the reasonable grade penalties are, and I wonder if the EPC has discussed this. If a student did violate this, how does, for example, failure of the course or reducing their grade suffice as the right kind of penalty for this kind of violation?
It would depend a lot on the case and the particular circumstances. Recall that particularly egregious violations could also be covered under the university's anti-doxing policy. So if a student went out to inflict harm on another student or a faculty member by outing them in a really aggressive way on social media that caused harm or danger to that individual, that would be covered separately and above from this. So that would be in addition to any academic integrity policy. I mean, the feeling is that, you know, this includes failure of a course, which is a fairly substantial sanction or penalty. It can include the full range of sanctions that are attached to academic integrity. So particularly egregious cases could be handled with other means as well, but we wanted to have something that spoke to this specifically in the classroom. And I will say also to set a norm and a practice, because I think right now there's a lot of unevenness or maybe unshared understandings about whether this is okay or not. I think that's true among faculty. It's very true among students who may have very little sense at all what the norms are about sharing beyond the classroom. So this is partly meant to set a threshold or a baseline for some of these discussions.
Hi, Iris Pacman, Senator with ILR, RTE. I was curious about how you establish permission. Is there a blanket assumption that you do not have permission unless it's been explicitly given? And have instructors all been informed that they need to make this announcement? Because I'm wondering, you know, if someone maybe isn't aware, they take a picture, they post it on social media, they're facing this. Is there an assumption, therefore, that they don't have permission? So what is that process?
So this is part of the socialization of the new policy. I hope you will help share this with faculty colleagues. I think we sent a note around, or we will be sending a note around this in the Monday message. Students have gotten this through the Essential Guide to Academic Integrity. My hope is to get some time with the student assembly sometime this fall to also share it that way. It will take some time to socialize this. If instructors want to amplify that in their class by saying, hey, remember, there's this new policy, and this is how this should operate in our class, that is welcome. But it will take time for us to all get on the same page around this.
Well, she wouldn't be in class because she was not supposed to.
You should ask people to mute themselves on Zoom.
People on Zoom should mute themselves. And maybe, David, one more, and then I think we do need to move on because I know we have limited time.
David Delchamps, Electrical and Computer Engineering. Two comments. One for Michael.
I need to speak more into the mic.
Okay. Here we go.
Now I can do it right now.
Anyway, for Michael, the grade penalties aren't the only kind of penalties, but that's the only kind of penalty an instructor can impose. If an instructor wants another penalty imposed, the instructor proposes that to the Academic Integrity Hearing Board, and they can impose a higher penalty that's more appropriate. Second thing is, in the code, there's a section called academic misconduct, okay, which is sort of like bad behavior, you know, disruptive classroom behavior. I'm just wondering whether this might belong there rather than in the integrity part. That's all.
So we talked about this with EPC and Council, and there is actually a small mention of some ancillary issues under that section, the classroom misconduct. It was decided that when we put it in there, it got too kludged together with other things. So partly because it's a change maybe to the code and the expectation, we wanted it to have its own subsection, named subsection. But I'm only giving you the core part of that. There's a mention earlier on in the, like a quick mention earlier on, and there's a mention in the academic misconduct part too.
And David, basically, in the academic integrity, you already can't do this with notes. So it was adding recording to that.
Okay, so next slide, please. And I'm going to, I'll turn things over to Rob.
Hi, everybody. Rob Vanderland, the Center for Teaching Innovation. We spent a fair amount of time this summer thinking about what might disrupt our learning in the fall, trying to learn the lessons from last year and thinking about what might be on the horizon this year that could pose challenges to faculty in the classroom and to students. And so I'm going to walk through some of the resources that we've created and shared, and also encourage you to share them with faculty in your departments, and also maybe share it with the message that if things arise or if your faculty have questions, we're always able to work in with individual consultations. That's particularly valuable when things go differently than expected, and we're happy to make those sorts of have those sorts of meetings. The first is, and I know you know many of you probably missed this. You were out walking in the woods last night or something, but there's a presidential election this year. There's a national election, and we've learned the hard way that these elections can have quite an impact on our students and on the student learning environment. 2016 was probably the real case of that. That was, I think, a moment that surprised a lot of people. I don't think we'll necessarily be super surprised this time, but the idea of a very contentious political election, a very close political election, one that might not be decided on election night, and an election where there's a lot at stake for a lot of our citizens, or a lot of our students in particular ways, means that we're sort of ripe for this having an impact on our teaching and learning. So we just want to encourage faculty to think about this in advance. It is so much easier to prepare a classroom environment in advance for disruption than it is to respond in the moment when you're sort of taken off guard or surprised. The first is recognizing that students are likely, many of our students are likely to have a strong response, and that response is varied, right? We have students that will be supporting different political candidates. We have students supporting different political candidates for very different reasons. And keeping that in mind, right, that it's very unlikely that our students are all going to feel the same way about what happens is really, I think, important. The second is thinking about, especially for particular disciplines or courses, are there pedagogical opportunities here, right? Are there opportunities to adapt your course content to issues that are relevant to this election campaign to help make the learning more relevant to our students in particular ways? This resource has some ideas for how to go about doing that. The second is just a simple reminder. Think about your assignments. Maybe no prelim on election night or the night thereafter. Think about where your students are going to be in their headspace when you're making your plans. Just a gentle reminder that there are restrictions on what even faculty with academic freedom in the classroom can and can't do in the classroom. Policy 4.18, which you see referenced here, we can't advocate for particular candidates or particular political platforms from the classroom, but you can certainly, and I would encourage you to, encourage students to vote, to get involved, to learn about the issues and the topics. Next slide, please. We also, last year, we saw a lot of controversy on campus, political events that began half a world away that resonated across the country and certainly on our campus. That could certainly happen again in ways that we can predict and also in ways that we can't predict. So we've created a number of resources to sort of help faculty prepare the classroom environment for those eventualities. It starts with taking the time to build a sense of community in the classroom, a classroom that has built up a sense of communication, shared values, and trust does a lot better when these sorts of politically contentious issues come to the fore. We also have a lot of resources on ways to engage viewpoint diversity in the classroom, to surface political differences, points of view, to create an environment where students feel empowered to venture risky ideas in the idea that those ideas may get critically examined, but that that will be done in a respectful and an inclusive way. I'd also point out that the Intergroup Dialogue Project has a great resource as well, Strategies for Cultivating Democratic Education and Dialogue. I think that, combined with our engaging viewpoint diversity, gives you a lot of options to think about how you might want to do this in your classroom. And then finally, just a reminder about inclusive teaching strategies, and that so many of these can do a lot of the work creating that classroom environment that is more resilient and robust and can handle challenging moments. Next slide. Finally, I'm just like all doom and gloom. Teaching during periods of disruption. This is something that these are resources we began to develop during the pandemic. Largest disruption to a learning environment that I've experienced and that I could think of. But we've continued to develop these because disruption to the teaching environment can happen in lots of different ways, right? We all know stories of faculty who start to teach a semester and then for health reasons can't continue and having to make that transition mid-semester. Sicknesses is always a risk. There are lots of risks. There's a particular risk that I think it's worthwhile thinking about in the coming semester and year. And I draw your attention to the email that went out to the grads from the grad school last Friday on teaching and research continuity in the eventuality that there be any sort of labor disruption with graduate students. That's always a possibility, and it's always worthwhile thinking about how you might prepare in advance. So this research, teaching during periods of disruption, is designed broadly to accommodate almost any disruption, but it might be particularly useful to look at through that lens now. And really, I won't go through the specifics here, but preparation in advance, making sure you have access to the grades, to the course materials that you would need to assess learning, preparing a communication plan in the interest of disruption so that students who may not have any idea what the impact of this is on them have as much current, clear, accurate information as possible, and then thinking about what adjustments you might need to make to your course expectations or plans. All of that is available on these resources. I'm happy to answer questions in the time that we have ahead. But again, you can also reach out directly, either with big picture questions or very specific course level. Thanks. Thank you.
The only other thing I'll call out here is, actually, can you go back just for 1 second? I hope people are following the update. Resources are coming from the grad school. That's the, you're getting the updates on bargaining as they happen. That's the best source on where things are at right now. In case it gets lost in your inbox, as it does in mine, graduateunionupdate@gradschool.com. And there's a really good set that will be extended and updated of FAQs at unionupdate.gradschool.cornell.edu. And to be clear, the things at the top they're linked, so we will circulate these slides after the meeting so you have access to the underlying links, but they're also easy to find, teaching.cornell.edu. The last thing I'll say on that, sorry, I keep coming back. We're at a moment where we are particularly interested to hear from departments and colleges about the specific impacts that they can imagine disruptions having on them, on their teaching and their research operations in particular. That's going to be really important as we begin to think through contingency planning, which is starting to happen. We continue to bargain in good faith with the union. We are hopeful that we will reach a resolution without a work stoppage, but it seems certainly possible that there will be a work stoppage in the coming months. And to that end, we also need to begin to think about how this is going to impact different parts of the university differently and begin to make some contingency plans accordingly. So. About how they engage students around the strike. It is absolutely the right of unionized workers at Cornell to strike. In the event of a work stoppage, our job as faculty members is also to treat students who choose to strike and choose any students who choose not to strike, treat them equivalently, right? We don't change our treatment of our students in response to that. So the notion of contingency planning is not meant to predict an outcome. It's not saying we're pretty sure a strike is going to happen, but we're also trying to not be caught entirely flat-footed. Most of the guidance that's in the document about preparing for disruptions is really focused at the teacher level, and it gives a lot of latitude to teachers to think through, to begin to think through, this is kind of in the preparation stage, how they might respond if there was some kind of work stoppage, which a disruption, which in this case could be a work stoppage, it could be COVID. These were originally reworked from our COVID resources, actually. It gives them a lot of contingency to think through how they might respond in their own classroom environment. So I don't think it's at all at odds with our commitments on academic freedom, and it doesn't presume an outcome or a direction of individual faculty members. It's a little bit more like the university thinking through, in some ways, the same thing that happened when the UAW went on strike earlier this semester. It's the practical question of how are we going to feed our students, right? That was the practical question the university was thinking through in that case. In this case, how do we continue and get through to the end of the semester, say, in the teaching and the research context, in the event of a work stoppage?
I would just add that's certainly not neutral at all. What that position is, just as with the UAW strike, is encouraging people to do struck work. And for the UAW strike, it was struck work where retired employees were being solicited to do it, where current employees were being solicited to do struck work. And as you said, this is similar. So the message, I think, that's going out is that faculty will be at the encouraged to do struck work, and that is very much a position about the strike, and that does affect our academic freedom to engage in governance and take positions about how the university governs itself, including in terms of things like fair contracts. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to raise that because it's presented as a given here, but I think that there are different positions people can take about it.
Okay, I take that point, and I'm happy to bring that back. Oh, yes. Do I have time?
We have maybe 8 or 9 minutes.
Okay, so I will go through this quickly. Next slide, please.
Oh, wait, Penn Berman had a question before we got disconnected. I wonder if he can still ask it.
I think we'd better move on, and if there's time at the end, Ken, maybe you could ask it in the general question set after this next item, so I do want to at least put this on the table. All right, so this actually touches on some of the things that Risa just raised, and it's around a discussion that I hope we can start to have around academic freedom in general, but in particular the thing I want to talk about today is academic freedom in classroom speech. And I'm pointing you to the main university policy on this, the faculty statement on academic freedom and responsibility, which was most substantially drafted in 1960 and then updated fairly modestly, I would say, in 2021. The university statement is drawn, I would say, primarily on AAUP principles that go back to 1915 and then 1940 and then some updates in the 1970s. And the point I want to make here, because we have lots of discussions, and some people have a good sense of these lines and some people less so, but the point I want to make here, the question I want to ask is, how do we think about academic freedom specifically in the classroom context, right? So I want to set this aside from other kinds of categories that are laid out separately in the AAUP. Basically, the AAUP and others can jump in and correct and add to this, but essentially there are kind of three categories of speech or academic freedom that are named under those guidelines. One is the kind of speech you can think of as research speech or speech in your research capacity as a faculty member. Another one is extramural speech, which you can think of as speech in the world at large, kind of like your speech as a citizen. And then the third one is, in fact, classroom speech. And sort of all three of these things are named in the AAUP and reflected broadly in the Cornell principles. So to be clear, there are certain kinds of constraints on the, in the classroom environment that are different than the kinds of constraints that exist in other kinds of environments. So if we go back to AAUP principles, classroom speech is limited by topicality. Broadly, is the speech connected to the subject of the class as determined by disciplinary peers, right? We rely on political scientists to tell us what is relevant to political science. We rely on physicists to tell us what is relevant to physics, et cetera. And by restrictions, this is the restriction that Rob just mentioned, on direct advocacy of an electoral campaign. So I can't stand up at the front of my class and say, I think you should vote for candidate X and here's why. Right? You can absolutely drive them to the polls. You can support them to vote. You can support them to vote where their vote makes a difference. All of that stuff is fine. We'll have a, I think, robust get-out-the-vote operation at Cornell. We usually do. I encourage you all to participate in that. The other thing I want to raise, and this is some older language and some newer language that's been coming into our world over the last couple of years, but our speech in the classroom may also be conditioned by the university's Title VI, Title VII, and Title IX obligations. Title IX, I think people are broadly familiar with. Title VI, people are becoming familiar with, and is around the civil rights requirement that all students receive a school environment free from discrimination or harassment based on race, color, or national origin, including shared ancestry or ethnic characteristics. Title VII is, you can think of it as kind of the workplace version of that. So if you had an interaction, the same kind of categories, but applying to a person that you have a working interaction with. So it might come up in your dealings with a TA in a class, for example, or in your research lab. Next slide, please. So one of my frustrations in thinking through these things as a faculty member and as we try and sort out challenging situations in the world is that it's been a while since we've had a serious faculty-level discussion of these issues, I believe. We are still going back to principles that are core to the university, core to universities in general through the AAUP, and I would say core to Cornell through the statements I've mentioned. But I also think it doesn't name all of the values and responsibilities, maybe on either side of the freedom and responsibility question, that I think many of us hold by. So this is one version of an extension of these things, which is, and given as an example, this is not proto-policy. There is no wider ambition here beyond kickstarting a conversation among faculty. I think this is a faculty, I am centrally a faculty member, believe it or not. I'm still half-time faculty, I guess it's an 80-80 appointment or a 90-90 appointment or something like that. But I really think that this is a discussion that needs to be had and rehad and periodically refreshed at the level of the faculty, because I think it's a faculty choice and a faculty decision. So these are some of my values. This is how I think about how I operate in the classroom. They may or may not be your values. What I would hope is that we can begin to have discussions maybe at the department level, if it's not happening at the department level, which I think it usually isn't right now happening at the department level, about what we think, how would we articulate, now if it was up to us, about our own work or about the work of our local colleagues in the department, how would we describe what we think are our academic freedoms and responsibilities? So this is one version of that. I won't walk all the way through it. There's other things that I think we're naturally that aren't mentioned here that probably also play into this. So when I'm teaching introduction to exology, I'm also accountable to what exologists in the world think exology is, right? Like I don't just make up my own version of an intro syllabus. I may be constrained by curricular structures, by an agreement I have with my faculty colleagues that, well, if you're teaching the intro class, in the second year class, we know we need them to do this, so make sure you cover this in the first year class, right? That's another very ordinary version of this. Next slide, please. Yeah, so that's it. That's actually it. And discuss. So what I've encouraged chairs and associate deans I've talked to to try and begin to have these conversations with faculty and their departments. You can use, if you want, it can be freedom and responsibility in the classroom. You could have people articulate, this is what freedom in the classroom means, should mean in our discipline and at our university. This is what responsibility in the classroom means and should mean in our discipline, our department, our university. There's some really tricky questions, right, just to point these out right away. And I think this is actually some of the complexities of navigating the world right now have to do with this trickiness. So what do we think, you know, even if we can arrive at something that we feel good about in the classroom, you can arrive at the department level. Well, how do we think about classroom adjacent spaces, labs, studios, office hours, living learning spaces, engaged teaching environments when we bring students out into the world? One of the great challenges that people will know in the old categorization of speech is that, in fact, probably those categories never were actually practically distinct, and arguably they're becoming less distinct. So many of our biggest challenges come in instances where these categories kind of collide. They overlap and collide, and then how do we think through that? So that's the invitation, and I don't know what the right form of this is. What I think the right form is for faculty to be talking more to each other about these questions at a local level. If people are interested in working up something more substantive or more generalized from the basis of those local conversations, I'm happy to learn from them and participate in them wherever helpful. But I do think it's a kind of question that we as faculty need to start having amongst ourselves so that we arrive at answers that we can all be happy with and that we feel actually reflect our own sense of freedoms and responsibilities in the work we do in the classroom today. So there may well be thoughts on this. Do we have time for?
Unless we take it from your. So without objection, let's just reallocate a few minutes from this agenda item from the next, if there are any last minute questions. Online,
Gilly.
Go ahead.
Hi, Steve. I have a quick clarification question. Does classroom speech relate to faculty speech and student speech in the same way? Are there any distinctions? Are there thoughts about how classroom speech coming from the instructor versus the student might differ in the way that they're handled and their impact on the classroom community and on the students and the faculty and so on?
That's a very good question. I'm particularly interested in here, and what I was speaking about is primarily from the standpoint of faculty members. Students are bound by other kinds of student code of conduct, and we could have this debate around students as well. We often rely on faculty to be the arbiters of sort of any conflictual and challenging student speech in those environments, the immediate on-the-scene arbiter. Some of the resources that Rob provides actually are really good at helping faculty think through those situations in which an explosive situation may be coming up, that they may be, feel a little bit like deer in headlights in knowing how to manage. And part of that is preparation and building kind of a climate in the community in which better, richer, more varied conversation, more honest and open conversations can be had. But what I'm interested in here particularly is how we think about the role of faculty members specifically. David and then Harold, if we have time for, yeah.
Thank you, Steve. Raise a lot of interesting questions. I just had one that I wanted that came up actually in one of the listening sessions for the expressive activity policy that Colleen Berry has been having, and it relates to this topicality question. I don't know the chapter and verse of AAUP's regs on this, but or guidelines on this, but it strikes me that it seems quite limiting. I know there's a lot of potential for going off in the other direction and it becoming politicized and so forth. But it seems to me there are a lot of instances, and I found over my 40 years of teaching, a lot of instances where either the material you're teaching can naturally lead into discussions of politics. I mean, for example, I taught international trade. Do we have tariffs or not? Well, we have a couple of candidates now and one wants tariffs. So there's a natural connection of the material to political issues that comes up. In addition, in class, we get questions that often wander into other areas that we want to address. And of course, in office hours, you have questions that come up on all sorts of topics. So I'm a little concerned that, you know, there's already a lot of self-censorship that goes on among faculty members. And I'm just concerned about what I think is an overly limiting interpretation of that topicality matter, regardless of whatever AUP says. I mean, I'm just bothered by it. And most of what you have covered seems very reasonable. That one, it seems to me, is a bit problematic.
Yeah, so the AAPU guidelines are not that long, and on topicality, there's not a lot more than what I've kind of explained here. It's the basic principle that's one point in which there could be a limiting factor. I mean, there's I also find it a not super useful and specific tool, partly for the reason you mentioned that conversations go where they will. And part of the art of teaching is kind of managing that and following that, also, but also constraining it and kind of putting it back on a track if it's becoming problematic in ways that challenge the classroom environment or the well-being of students in a deep way. But I also think that the topicality. I talked about that reason, topicality. The other version that's come up is it's not meant to be a conservative break on the evolution of fields, right? So what, at a certain point in time, a person in field X think is relevant to the field may in fact evolve, right? And we expect our classrooms and our fields and our disciplines to evolve. So I actually don't find topicality a super useful limiting factor in this way, because when you get into the limits of individual cases or the details of individual cases, I don't think it provides you a very clear and easy guide for determining which direction to go in.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Harold, and then Risa, and then I think we'll probably have to move on.
Hi, Harold Hodes in philosophy. Mostly, I guess I'm reiterating David Lee's worries. I'm wondering whether the rules in force now require faculty members who are teaching about normative issues to be coy about expressing their own views. And I can well imagine that someone might complain that, oh, the fact this professor is indoctrinating us, when in fact, and in order to avoid such a charge, I can well imagine that professors would be tremendously reluctant to actually say what they think on certain matters. And that, I think, would impede learning and impede discussion. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I feel that it would be good to have more clarity about what limits, what sort of self-censorship is appropriate from faculty members. I hope it's not a high level of self-censorship.
I think that's a good and important question. The rules in place, there are not a lot of rules in place. So I think that's actually part of the story here. So what I would say is everything you've said, I would say articulates a value that some of that you're going to put on the freedom side, maybe of that freedom and responsibility chart or whatever you do with it. But that's exactly the kind of conversation I want faculty to be thinking about, but to be talking about. I also share that concern. I think that's a really important question for us to think through as we think about academic freedom and classroom speech and how we teach in general. But that's part of the reason I want there to be a more sort of robust and widespread conversation on this than we've had to date, because if people are self-censoring, I would want them to say, hey, I'm self-censoring, and I don't think that's right, and I actually think that I want to articulate a more robust set of things on the freedom side, and or I also think that there are particular kinds of responsibilities. Maybe there are particular kinds of things I want my faculty colleagues to be doing that I think they're not doing, that I think we're underserving our community or our students on. But both sides of these, I think, need more development than we have, because the existing rules are really not rules or applied as rules in any clear way. Risa, I'd be happy to chat later if we're...
Quickly, you asked for one. Risa Lieberwitz, ILR. I'm also the president of our Cornell chapter of the AUP. The AUP, I think, the AUP's position was not accurately presented.
Okay.
The AUP doctrine, well, not doctrine, but policies and principles, including in our report from AUP on freedom in the classroom, makes clear that controversial discussions are part of academic freedom. It makes clear that the notion of discussing issues that are germane to the subject matter is a broad area, not a narrow area. And so the AUP's position is consistent with what David Lee was saying and what Harold was saying, mm-hmm. In terms of encouraging broad statements, broad discussions, not narrow ones. Mm-hmm. And I encourage your office and perhaps in other offices to send out the actual AUP documents, because there are a number of them, and I'd be happy to supply those.
Yeah, and they're linked through this slideshow, too, and in other things we've shared.
Other ones, but thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, we have to move on. Thank you, Steve. Okay, we're going to move to the next agenda item items and turn it over for announcements and updates to Eve DeRosa, Dean of Faculty, and Chelsea Specht, Associate Dean of Faculty.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to, one, remind you there's a reception immediately after. I've encouraged faculty, I just sent out a blast for them to come meet you guys, so hopefully there'll be faculty out there waiting for us. Please pick up these posters. We're using these to help your departments know where to go when they want topics to come to the Senate, or if they want to discuss things that we're discussing actively in the Senate this year. Here essentially is the work of the Nominations and Elections Committee. The Nominations and Elections Committee is a committee that's been elected in by the entire faculty to build our ballots for elections, but also to appoint faculty members to the different committees. We have 12 plus two working groups, and actually 13 plus two working groups, and so this is who they've appointed for, these are the new appointees for the coming year. If you have any concerns about anybody you see listed here, just let the office know, but otherwise I'll accept that everyone approves their work. Next slide, please. One of the working groups that we are standing this year is to look at the Academic Integrity Code. And we are going to be working on making it more efficient. We're learning that, especially our newest faculty, they are not pursuing violations of the academic code. And so we're working with all the colleges and schools, including the professional schools. So the graduate school, law school, tech, the vet school are seeing increases in academic integrity violations. We had last year talked about the pilot program in Bauer CIS, the College for Computing and Information Science. And that program is going to help us also build standardized ways of communicating and getting the data of where we're seeing academic integrity violations. Is it being reported to the students' college, et cetera? And that pilot program is also trying to move Cornell from being one of the most punitive universities in terms of academic integrity to one in which students have an opportunity to learn. And so this is the work of this committee. I have names for all but two, and I will send out invitations to the people who have been nominated by their college and school. Next slide, please. So I am linking to the graduate student unionization as well, the updates. I think the updates are important for faculty. Risa, absolutely. It is our academic freedom to choose how we engage with any work stoppage. But I just want to let people know that if they make whatever choice they make, they can be planful about it. And so just to think about research and teaching of continuity and what it means to you as an individual. I wanted to update the Senate, so the hard work of the T4 committee, who worked to think through adding teaching professor RTE title to our academic titles. So Michael over here, Michael Clarkson, and Charlie Van Loon, our previous dean of faculty, did beautiful work to get all the colleges and schools to have a enabling legislation. We approved it that allows colleges and schools to now cater this title to their specific unit. And so this went to the academic committee of the academic affairs committee of the Board of Trustees. I presented it there, they approved it. And the governance committee just has to basically update the bylaws and the titles. And all colleges and schools can then bring this title and start to advertise probably in November, December. And a few of the colleges already are writing their legislation, college-specific legislation. Ah, road trip. Thank you, Senator Lamb and Senator Holm. So we had our orientation for new senators last week and then had a little cocktail party with all the other assemblies and with our interim president and our interim provost. And maybe it was the wine, I don't know, but basically putting walking for what we talk, I guess I don't know how to say it best, but the idea that we do represent three campuses. And so in speaking to both senators, I realized that there's an opportunity. And so I'm inviting senators to come to the AgriTech campus and come to the Tech campus with me. And what we'll do is have a faculty forum from those campuses and hear about the issues local to them. And so we'll hire a bus and up to 50 people, the first 50 people who wanna come, we'll do that. So over this academic year, we're going on a road trip and everyone can decide for themselves if they have the time and energy. And I think it would be lovely. I just wanted to change the dynamic a little bit. Break the mold just a little bit for us to have, I think, just context-specific conversations about our campuses. Next slide, please. And the final thing that I wanted to do, I've been really thinking about how do we build our community. I think a lot of us are struggling and are feeling a little bit vulnerable. That's what I'm hearing around campus. And so I changed the prompt a little bit from what I wrote on the agenda. I want us to think as a faculty over this, over the academic year, what it means to be at Cornell, considering our founding principles of any person, any study, and what it means now relative to when the vision was instantiated, but also what it can mean into the future. And so I think we're at a time of transition. We have an interim provost, we have an interim president, and maybe a gift that we can give to the new president and the new provost is what the faculty's vision is for themselves. And so that's the conversation I would like to have. I'm going to set up a few of these conversations around the campus, and maybe we can also have when we go to AgriTech, you know, what's the future of any study in that context? What's the future of our academics and our study on the Tech campus? And so we'll have a launch. I thought today maybe people could start thinking through what it means to them, any person, any study now or, and 10 years from now. We also have an opportunity, so we invited the interim president, Kotlikoff, to come speak to just the senators. So it's just us and him. And I thought this is also an opportunity for us maybe to have that conversation there. And so with that, I open the floor to anybody who would want to start contributing to that. And maybe Jill just keep up that prompt, like the slide before. And I can do the awkward silence thing really well. Yeah, Risa's on her way.
And furthermore, Risa Lieberwitz, ILR, I was waiting since I had talked a lot, but I'm so glad that you've raised this. I think this is a very worthy discussion. And what I would put out there is any person, any study in relation to who is doing the teaching. And so what I want to point to is who actually has academic freedom that's meaningful, as an extension from our last discussion, who has academic freedom in the classroom, in extramural speech, in research, in governance, which we call intramural speech at AUP, who really has that academic freedom that's meaningful? And what does it mean to have, you know the statistics, is it more than half or half of our faculty who are not on the tenure track or tenured?
Less than half.
Okay, close to half, around 40%?
It's like 43%.
Okay, about 43% of our faculty colleagues do not have job security and they are not on a tenure track towards job security. What does that mean for what we teach, how we teach, and whether any person can study in a broad way by having a faculty who are free to question, to be controversial, to push against the status quo, et cetera.
Thank you for starting the conversation, Risa. And as you can see, one of the things I didn't emphasize is that this is the any, in my, from my point of view at least, that what I consider the any person is about our community. And this, I think that's what Risa's speaking to. Who are we as faculty? But also, I think that I want us to also be visionary about our studies and our academics. And one of the things that I'll do likely after each of these events is ask people who participated in these events to articulate their futuristic person study. And then we'll save all of these and compile them and hand this gift to our next president and provost. I know faculty are not shy. Is that you, Noah? Come on up.
Hello, Nathan Matias, Senator Communication Department. I just want to reflect that quite a few folks in our department, some of who study questions related to student diversity, have been concerned about the impact on our campus and other campuses of recent Supreme Court decisions and so forth on enrollment. There have been really dramatic and I think at MIT, a 10 percentage point reduction in the percentage of black students just in 1 year, for example. And so I think as we think about this any person, one of the things I think our department would be very eager to see a new president take on would be what can we as Cornell do in the policy realm to ensure that our institution is able to continue to live up to even what we've accomplished in the past as an institution.
And I think part of this exercise, thank you so much, Matias, like one of the, I think what's important in this conversation is that we're also listening to each other. And that this is going to be crucial to this, that we're listening to each other. We learn, relearns for some people to respect each other and the expertise that we bring to this university. So, I mean, one thing we could do also is have this conversation in departments, and I'm happy to be there.
Laurent Dubreuil, I have the pleasure to be the senator of two departments for one semester, comparative literature and Roman studies in arts and sciences. I would say that part of the revolution at the pedagogical and academic level that Cornell brought was precisely this any person plus any study, which for any study included the practical elements of knowledge that were not taught at the time in the U.S. I would say that historically, and probably today as well, Cornell has focused a lot on any person, not to say that it's perfect, but clearly a huge part of the conversation that is just beginning today will really explore what any person could mean. What I feel in almost my 20 years here is that the any study part has really been shrinking quite dramatically. And especially the innovation of Cornell that consisted in including the applied parts of knowledge has led to a situation today where we see that everything that is fundamental research and not directly applied, so the humanities, but not only the humanities, theoretical parts of the sciences, tend to be under attack and tend to be shrinking quite dramatically. And I would like us to really understand that for the same reasons it was innovative in the 1860s to include a vet school, to include more professionalized elements of knowledge, it is absolutely crucial and innovative today in a world that is more and more tech-oriented and more engineered, I would say. It is absolutely crucial to respect and expand the role of what is theoretical and what is not immediately applied.
Thank you, Laurel.
Big Modalit government. I guess I'm...
Come stand here, because this...
Sorry. No, it's okay. Big Malay government, I missed the new senator orientation because it's our national conference, and so this is my first formal Senate meeting, and I'm sorry, my first Senate meeting, it has felt a bit like a whiplash, to be honest. We started by being told how to respond to a likely graduate union strike and how to prepare in the eventuality of that. We're being told about how to limit ourselves to topicality and how to respond to controversy around campus, and ending with a reassurance about any person, any study. These seem like the most contradictory.
I'm going to reinterpret, I think. But your impression is that the first half of this, or a good portion of our meeting, you felt like your academic freedoms were being restricted. So I would say that Steve would not have wanted that to be the communication, that it was more about, as faculty, how do you manage your classroom? And every faculty can approach their classroom as they wish. And so for those who might want one of these tools, here they are. For those that don't need them, don't want them, don't use them. I think that that's where we are. And then in terms of this conversation, I really am thinking about what we owe each other. So one is very much about us as scholars and what we do in the classroom, and what we do as our scholarship. But I think also I want this to be a conversation amongst faculty where we learn from each other. So for me, I think one's very like self-oriented and the other one's very other-oriented. So Will will be our last. Of course, we can still do this over wine. So Will.
Woo-hoo, last. Bill Katz, CVM. Just thinking outside of the classroom a little bit, this is obviously a research university, and something that comes up whenever people talk about the next couple of years of research is that research funding is getting incredibly difficult to get. The amount of funding hasn't gone up by a penny in years now. The cost of research has skyrocketed. So I think how we continue as a research university and continue, especially with the associate professors, finding funding, continuing to keep their labs open is going to have to be part of this conversation.
Okay, we have one more agenda item. I do want to remind everyone there's a reception following in the park atrium, which is somewhere out there. We have now 5 minutes for good of the order. Speaking will be Yuval Grossman, Department of Physics.
Thank you very much. So, as we all know, last year was extremely hard, and I really hope that next year will be better. And there's many things that should be changed at Cornell, obviously. And today I'd like to talk only about one case that actually regards to us as faculty members. And what we observed is that many instances of political activism in the classroom. We've touched upon it earlier in this meeting. And what I'd like to do today is actually tell you something of the way I was actually seeing those and share some of the reaction that I got from some Jewish students, the way they felt, how this activism affected them. Okay? I trust that we all agree that our students should feel welcome at any academic setting that they must attend. And this is especially important for those who are more on the passive side and do not have the means to actually be involved in counter-activism. So let me briefly discuss just two examples so we have an idea what's going on. So the first involved a chair of a department who used the department email to send a political email to everybody in the department stating, "I'm doing this not as a chair." A Jewish student was shocked by this email, feeling that the chair inappropriately used her position to distribute such content. I assume the chair did not realize how offensive and inappropriate this was. She could have sent it from her personal email using a personal email list that she does. Instead, she used the email list that is provided by the university for academic purposes only for doing activism. The second example I'd like to mention is concern a course syllabus. So a professor wrote in the course syllabus as following. He writes like this: "College is an exciting and formatting time, but can be stressful." And then he move on to give examples. And the first example is from the genocide in Gaza. And then he continued and said, "If you need support, please do not hesitate to reach out to me or others here at Cornell." And this is shocking. I would like to believe that this was done with good intention and that the professor didn't understand how offensive and how so inappropriate it was to include such extremely one-sided words in the course syllabus. Okay? And what happened after? Indeed, one Jewish student dropped the course immediately just by seeing the syllabus. That's the impact of doing it. So these are just two examples, and unfortunately, I have many, many examples. It's been a very widely phenomena on campus. And what I'm here to tell you is, are you all of us, to actually please try to keep it out of the classroom. In particular, it's not about debating what is okay and what is not okay to do in the classroom. It's about us. It's about us to say, do I really want to bring this activism to the classroom? Or maybe I should actually keep my activism outside of the classroom. I personally always do this. I will never come with the Israeli flag to the classroom. I will never say anything about what's going on, okay? I will not share my personal story in the classroom. I will do it outside the classroom. And I really hope that we all can come to agree that we should actually really come to the student, keeping our personal things in a way that is not offending them. Thank you.
Thank you. That is our last order of business. So remember to go to the park atrium, and the meeting, it's right out there. Oh, not the park atrium? Right here is the name of the location, the venue. The meeting is adjourned.